I'm going to pretend like you're in a cinema or a movie. Please turn off your ringers on your phone. There's no flying popcorn or candy here, but if you could do that, I'd appreciate it. And I do need to take attendance, but I don't have my sheet, so I'll let you start, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, I'd like to welcome everybody to the Secretary's Advisory Committee meeting. This is the 26th meeting of the Advisory Committee on Heritable Disorders in Newborns and Children. Because of the changeover that's occurred in, from the last meeting, we thought that, and the new members who have joined, that it would be good to start off by orienting the committee to the Secretary's Committee and to HHS. So we're going to start this morning with a review of some of the to provide that orientation, and then we'll get into the regular committee meeting. So we're going to start first with a discussion of ethics for special government employees. Dheeraj Agarwal is here from the HRSA Office of Management, Division of Workforce Management. He is an ethics advisor in HRSA's Division of Workforce Management. And his role is to advise HRSA employees on all ethics matters, and he'll go over the ethics specific to special government employees. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. What we'd like to do is, in the interest of time this morning, because I know Dr. Wakefield is on the agenda for 9 o'clock, we've got an excellent video that the Office of Government Ethics has produced that specifically talks about ethics for special government employees, and it covers the key areas such as financial conflicts of interest, misuse of position, teaching, speaking, and writing, appearance of bias or loss of impartiality. So what we'd like to do is to go ahead and run that video, and at the conclusion of the video, if we have time, we'll take questions, and if there are, if we do not have time, then what we will do is take any questions that are particular to your situation as it relates to ethics offline, and we will research those and get back to you. So if I could ask the folks to please turn on the video, I would appreciate it.
Because he's a consultant, Al Dover is used to giving advice and information. but now as a special government employee advising the Navy on a new fighter plane. Al must be careful about what he says and does because of some very specific ethics laws and rules. The government ethics issues facing people like Neil Everett, Janet Franklin, and Al Dover actually arise before they physically show up to perform their government service. The questions arise first on paper.
Your elections were perfect. I even found a spot in front of the building. But I thought all the paperwork was finished.
Almost. I just had a couple of questions about some of these items in your financial disclosure form.
All the stuff I owe the DSI, yes.
Aren't they building the airframe for the plane that we consulted on?
DSI?
Yes.
You know, there's a criminal law that prohibits you from taking any action on behalf of the government that could affect your personal financial interests.
I thought I'd sell the stock before I started working on the project.
Okay. But that might not be necessary.
Why not?
Well, it all depends on how much stock you have. If your holdings aren't substantial, you might be able to get a waiver.
You mean if I get a waiver, I can keep the stock? No. I was going to sell the stock anyway.
Well, that's all that. But there's still the matter of your wife's stock in Gilchrist Corporation.
Gilchrist? What's the problem with that?
Well, there's a sub on the DSI contract. They're supplying the troop release patents for the new plane.
I didn't know.
Naturally, any advice you give us could affect the subcontractors.
Of course. I just don't know if my wife will want to sell the stuff right now.
The same thing applies. If her holdings aren't substantial, you might be able to get a waiver, just from the Milkhouse stuff.
I don't really know how much she has. Can I check it with your call?
Sure, no problem.
Great. Suppose we have no problem.
Section 208 of the Criminal Code prohibits employees from acting on behalf of the government in certain matters in which they or their spouses have a personal financial interest. That's why Al's stock in the prime contractor building the plane and his wife's stock in one of the subcontractors presented problems. In conflict of interest cases like this, one solution is for employees simply not to work for the government on matters in which they have a financial interest. But sometimes, as the Navy ethics official explained, if the financial interest is not substantial, the restriction can be waived. Of course, selling the asset that created the conflict is also an option. Employees are also prohibited from acting officially in matters in which their minor children or private employers have an interest. How can a private employer's interest create a conflict? Ask Janet Franklin.
Well, congratulations, that's exciting.
Yeah, the Food and Drug Administration, I'm flattered.
I'm sure it's not on the server.
What's that?
Well, it seems to me that any drug testing standards your committee recommends for the industry are going to affect the grants you're working on here.
Yes, right, they probably will.
So, isn't that a conflict of interest?
I suppose so. But the whole reason the NPA wanted me on their committee was because of my research experience here.
Yeah, but if you're seen as a conflict, how can you...
Apparently it's a very typical problem. That's why I was granted a special waiver.
A waiver provision in Section 208 can be used to exempt special government employees like Janet if the official appointing them certifies that the need for their services outweighs the potential for a conflict of interest. Janet was a good candidate for this kind of waiver because she's a highly regarded expert in her field and because her employer, the medical center, wasn't going to be affected by the committee's work any more than other medical research facilities. Don't get the idea, though, that waivers under Section 208 are routine. Take Neil Everett, our art history professor, reviewing grant applications for a National Endowment for the Humanities peer review panel. He was told he'd have to disqualify himself from considering any applications that were submitted by his employer, Hanford University. Neil was also warned that reviewing certain other applications might call into question his impartiality.
All of those people want grants?
These are just the ones my panel has. Like the sectors, international shows. Uh-oh.
What?
This one's from Marlin University, the Art Museum.
I didn't know anything about it. That's first division.
That may not matter. How's it going to look if I recommend a grant?
for the art museum where my wife works. Neil would probably face reasonable concerns about his impartiality if he participated in a matter affecting his wife's employer. Because of these concerns, Neil should disqualify himself from reviewing that particular application, unless the agency he's working for specifically authorizes him to participate. When grant applications being reviewed are part of a competitive application process, reviewers like Neil sometimes have to disqualify themselves from reviewing an entire pool of applications, even if there's a conflict involving only one of the applications in the pool. A spouse's employment is not the only way impartiality issues can arise.
Robert, I didn't know you were running. Well, I tried. Great day for it, though.
Oh, you're right about that.
I'm hearing good things from the program officer about your work on our new bird.
Thank you, sir. Things are going pretty well.
Listen, Dover, I might have something else for you guys. We've got some problems with those rotor blades we're trying to retrofit on the CH-32 choppers. Sounds like it's right up your alley.
I'd love to help you out, Admiral, but it's an engineering dynamic making those blades.
Yeah, that could be a problem.
A problem? Well, let's say the appearance of a problem. You see, I finished the job for the last month. No defense stuff, but you know what that looked like.
I didn't know you'd work for engineering dynamics.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what. I'll have someone run it by our ethics officials. I'll get back to you later in the week.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Because Al worked as a consultant to engineering dynamics within the last year, his working for the Navy on a matter involving this company might present an appearance problem. The rule is, if a reasonable person would question Al's impartiality, then he shouldn't work on the project, unless he's specifically authorized to by the Navy. Conflicting financial interests, impartiality, or appearance concerns. Are there any other ethics issues that affect special government employees?
Jen, I understand you're working with the FDA now.
Yes, I'm on the committee. Really fascinating. I've never done anything like this before.
Drug testing, isn't it? Quite a responsibility. It's going to make a big difference in the industry.
Yeah, I suppose it will.
I'm talking to a lot of companies too, aren't you? I hear Metatron has some fancy new laser analyzer. Do you know anything about that?
Forget it, Sam. I can't talk to you about any confidential information. Excuse me.
Oh, well, buy you lunch. There's no law against that, is there? Hey, where's the birthday boy?
As a matter of fact, there are rules limiting acceptance of gifts by federal employees, and that includes some meals. In general, you cannot take gifts from people or organizations that seek some kind of action by the agency you're working for, do business or seek to do business with the agency you're working for, conduct activities that are regulated by the agency you're working for, or have interests that may be substantially affected by how you perform your official duties. Also, you can't accept gifts given to you because of your official position. No thanks. For Janet, the rules mean no gifts from pharmaceutical companies that are regulated by or are trying to get drugs approved by the FDA. For Neil, that means no gifts from universities or museums applying for NEH grants. And Al can accept gifts from companies that have Navy contracts or companies that are bidding on Navy contracts. There are sensible exceptions that allow you to accept gifts from family members or personal friends. And it's okay to accept gifts based on outside business or employment relationships. For example, suppose Janet's firm invites her to a golf outing. She can accept, as long as the invitation is given to her because of her employment relationship, not because of her position on the FDA advisory committee. By the way, you're permitted to accept occasional gifts that are valued at under $20 per occasion, provided the gifts don't total more than $50 from one source in 1 year. So an infrequent gift of lunch at the local sandwich shop shouldn't be a problem. Just as you can continue to accept most of the gifts you're used to accepting, Your employment with the government should not significantly affect other business or personal activities. There are, however, some special ethics rules on teaching, speaking, and writing. Like many special government employees who've been hired because of their particular expertise, Al does quite a bit of writing and speaking in his field. Al can continue doing most of these activities, but there are some important rules about what he can and cannot do, and about the compensation he's allowed to accept.
There are any more questions?
I was wondering, Dr. Dover. Now, I know you're working on the wing stress problem with the F-29 jet for the Navy. Can you comment on what you've found so far?
Well, first of all, I'm working on the F-29 for the government, so I can't talk about that in any depth. I can say, however, that generally the problem relates to corrosion, and that's typical for any aircraft that operates in a marine environment. And second, our work is still preliminary, so until it becomes public, I can't discuss it. Any more questions?
Dr. Dover, you mentioned something.
Al is free to make a presentation on airplane stress. That's his area of expertise, based on his experience and his educational background. And he can accept a fee for that. There's also nothing wrong with a brief mention of his work at the Navy. But Al can't disclose non-public information under any circumstances. And as a general matter, he can't accept compensation if his talk or any writing or teaching he does deals in any significant part with his government work. There are a few other limitations on outside teaching, speaking, or writing. You cannot accept compensation if the activity itself, giving a lecture, for example, is something you're doing as part of your government duties. You cannot accept compensation if you were offered the opportunity primarily because of your position with the government, rather than because of your expertise. And you cannot accept compensation if the invitation or the compensation comes from an organization or a person that may be affected substantially by how you perform your government duties. There are also restrictions imposed by criminal statute on the extent to which special government employees can represent others to the government, whether or not compensation is involved.
Four.
Al,
great talk.
Thank you. I haven't seen you in a while. What are you up to these days?
Well, we're still working on that reconnaissance plane. Mm-hmm. The truth is, we've run into some snags.
Snags?
Yeah, we're in the process of putting together some experts to go over and talk to the engineers at NAVAIR. What's your schedule, Mike Al?
Oh, no, I would love to, but I'm the other
person. Al is a special government employee who's been serving the Navy over 60 days in the last 1 year period. Because of this, he can't represent anyone else to the government on specific party matters that are pending before the Navy. Matters like the reconnaissance plane contract between the Navy and the company Paul works for.
I'm sorry, Paul, but that's why I can't do it. Can you process for me?
You should know, however, that nothing prevents you from representing yourself as an individual to the government. There's also an exception that may apply if you want to represent a family member. Suppose you begin looking for a new job. Are there any ethics restrictions on what you can do while you continue working as a special government employee? And what about after you complete your government service? Are there restrictions on what you can do then?
Yeah. And how are you?
This is wild. I was just thinking about you.
What are you doing in Washington?
Funded.
That's what I was thinking about you. So you came to submit a grant application for
Vegas. We need someone, and your name came up.
But there's enough for lunch in my tree.
Not really. I was just going to grab a hot dog.
Want to tag along?
Sure.
Well, it sure gives you on this. You'd be perfect. Especially now with all you know about NH grants.
Uh-huh.
So, what do you think?
Then go.
It's just, well, you put in that grant request for the Casaccio, didn't you?
Sure did. Anything to tell me?
No. No. In fact, Diane, I'd love to work on this Van Gogh thing, but I'm on the panel that's supposed to review your Casaccio application, and...
You can't do it, right?
Well, not exactly. I mean, not as long as I'm connected to your Casaccio grant. But maybe the agency could find someone else to do that review.
Could they do that?
I think so. Then I'd be free to talk about working on the Van Gogh retrospective. Let me see if there's a way to work this out.
Great. How about that hot dog?
Okay.
Since Neil has now begun seeking employment with Diane's Museum, the rule is that he can no longer act officially on matters that would affect the financial interests of the museum. Unless, of course, his agency specifically authorizes him to.
Excuse me.
Huh?
Look, my government appointment is just about up, and I love this Van Gogh job. Am I going to have a problem here?
Not if you disqualify yourself immediately, you won't.
Are you sure? I thought there were criminal laws against representing someone back to the government after you leave government. What do they call them? Post-employment restrictions.
Well, you're right, but in this case, working on the Van Gogh retrospective would be fine. Relax. Go get some lunch. For most government employees, like Neil, the post-employment restrictions only bar former employees from representing others back to the government on the same particular matters involving specific parties that they worked on as a government employee. The Van Gogh retrospective is a new matter, so it doesn't raise a post-employment problem for Neil. Suppose, though, that the art exhibit Neil is asked to represent on is not new and different. Suppose it's a matter he worked on for the NEH. Would that change Neil's post-employment options? Well, let's take a look.
So I think we'll have to work with OG to make that high definition because it's rather old. But while it is an old video, it actually covers all of the ethical areas that apply to special government employees. And we think it's an excellent video because it does talk and give you all examples of such things as an appearance of conflict or how you can get an exemption or what you can do in the teaching, writing, or editing arena, and so forth. One of the cardinal rules that we advise in the ethics department is that if you think that you have an ethics issue, or even if you have any particular matter that you think may come up in the future that presents an ethical conflict, always come to us first. It is our job to research it to see if there is a real conflict or to see if there is an appearance of conflict. And in either situation, our job is to work with you and the appropriate parties to make sure that there is a remedy. And as the video spoke to, there are different ways to remedy a conflict of interest, everything from waivers to authorizations to divestitures to actually resigning from your special government employee position. So are there any questions that I may take at this point in time? And if there are not, what we can do is if you come up with any particular questions as you take in what you saw today, we will be able to research those and get back to everyone as appropriate.
Thank you very much. Any specific questions at this point? If not, again. Dieter?
Since this meeting is public, we don't have to worry about what we talk about to others about it, right? This is a public meeting, so
yes.
We don't have to worry about what we tell others.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I now have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Mary Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield is the administrator of Health Resources Service Administration, HRSA. She was named administrator in 2009 by President Barack Obama, and she took this position while she was associate dean for rural health at the School of Medicine at University of North Dakota, where she was associate dean for rural health at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences. She has considerable experience both on Capitol Hill and leadership roles, policy development at multiple institutions, including serving as director of the Center of Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University and working as a consultant for the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS. So, Dr. Wakefield, we appreciate you taking the time to come to the committee.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with all of you. And congratulations, and let me also thank you, Mr. Chair, for your willingness to lead this advisory committee's very important work going forward. We've had the pleasure of being able to meet and talk a little bit about the agenda and the way the committee conducts its work prior to today. I appreciated that opportunity, and as I said, we're most appreciative of your willingness to chair the committee. I would also want to welcome new advisory committee members and extend my appreciation to each of you for your willingness to join the ranks of the committee. It's a committee, for those of you that are new, that has a terrific record of substantive contributions, and we, of course, expect that reputation will be carried forward. And special thanks to the full advisory committee members who have been serving to date. The work has been very important to us in terms of guiding and influencing national dialogue as it pertains to infants, children, families that are impacted by heritable disorders. So thanks to all of you, and a special welcome to new committee members. I also want to take this opportunity to recognize Dr. Michael Liu, who is our new associate administrator for the Maternal Child Health Bureau, through which, of course, this advisory committee is supported. He is well-known in his field, and we're just delighted that he has agreed to be part of HRSA's leadership team. We look forward to a lot of great work and contributions that will come both from him and from the team that he leads going forward in terms of maternal child health. So welcome to Michael. He, for those of you who may not know, is relatively new on the job, although he's been there now for over a week. And we had a lengthy conversation yesterday, and it was, well, here are the 44 things I'd like to see happen. Dr. Liu, how quickly can we make them happen? He's still trying to find his way around the Park Lawn building. And so, again, for those of you who've been to the Park Lawn building, you would appreciate that even that battle in and of itself is a challenge. But the good news is he's got a not just expertise, but high energy and commitment. And there's a lot of great work to be done. So you'll be interfacing, of course, with him more as our representative on the committee going forward. I appreciate the opportunity and the invitation to be here and spend just a few minutes with you to talk a little bit about your work and some of the broader work in which your deliberations are part. Clearly, your committee offers consumers, family members, healthcare providers, national organizations and advocacy, other advocates, our researchers and state health officials, a vehicle through which they can join forces, if you will, to really try to bring expertise to inform the work that all of us are engaged with an aim of reducing mortality and morbidity associated with genetic disorders. The utility and the relevance of your work is apparent in a lot of different ways, and I want to just give you a few examples. For example, the systematic reviews that this committee has coordinated have provided new mechanisms for evidence-based reviews of rare conditions, an important contribution. Additionally, this committee has offered really a unifying voice for the consideration of modifications or additional conditions to the newborn screening program. And this committee is also a link to a very dynamic and expanding field of genetics and public health. What an interesting nexus that, at least in my former training as a nurse, I wouldn't have been thinking about back in the late 70s, mid-70s, to be perfectly honest, when I graduated from my nursing education program. And that link also helps to provide a framework for the discussion of those interactions in the context of public health and the field of genetics. I'd also say that just for illustrative purposes, with a little more specificity, in other words, that we could consider what has followed your 2010 recommendations to begin screening for severe combined immunodeficiency disorder. Pilot studies in various states currently now cover approximately 25% of births in the United States. And according to your May 2011 report, nearly 962,000 newborns have been screened and 60 infants, or about 1 in 16,000, have been identified with some form of immune deficiency. 14 infants with SCID have been diagnosed and received treatment, and your committee report concluded that screening for SCID has almost certainly saved lives. Just one concrete example of the impact, if you will, of the work of your committee. In many ways, I think that this advisory committee helps to level the playing field for infants across the nation. No longer are some states, for example, only screening for 3 or 4 conditions and others screening for more than 30 conditions, but now we've got a standardized approach across the country, a more robust set of screenings with a minimum requirement of 29 disorders screened so that infants don't any longer, across those 29 disorders, miss the potential for life-saving and life-altering screenings just by virtue of where they live. So it's an important contribution, another example of an important contribution of this committee's work. The CDC has recognized the advances in newborn screening and your important role in guiding the field and setting standards with a uniform screening panel. CDC found, quote, that improvements in technology and endorsement of a uniform newborn screening panel of diseases have led to earlier life-saving treatment and intervention for at least 3,400 additional newborns each year with selected genetic and endocrine disorders, end quote. Furthermore, for example, another example, the percentage of infants that now receive hearing tests has risen from less than half of all babies born in the United States in 1999 to 97% today. So simply put, those illustrations, I think, underscore that the efforts of this committee have had in very real and direct ways an impact on the health of infants and children. 5 years ago, you advised that newborn screening was one component of a larger process. Your 2007 roadmap report envisioned, quote, a broad enterprise of which long-term follow-up is an essential part, and an enterprise that involves many players who need to work in partnership, close quote. And somewhat related to that, in your 2009 advisory report recommendations, you counted primary care professionals as a subset of those key important players. As you noted, quote, primary care providers should recognize that genetics and genomic medicine will be an integral component of care and should develop an effective strategy for incorporating emerging clinical genetic medicine recommendations into their clinical practice, end quote. So very important contributions. HHS and HRSA are very proud to have the committee as a partner and as a resource to inform our work, too. In addition to reflecting back, though, in the minutes that I have with you, I also want to take just a look forward in a couple of key areas. And I want to stop for a second because I failed to do something that I should have, and that is to also acknowledge some other HRSA staff that that have done just a spectacular job in supporting the efforts of this committee and that make major contributions in their own right in the context of improving health for children and women. And that would be Bonnie Strickland in the back of the room. Bonnie has been a key link to this committee's work and is probably in my office where we've been talking about your work more often than she'd like to because this is just part of her portfolio of activity. But she's a very enthusiastic and committed supporter of what you do. And even more directly, of course, Dr. Sarah Copeland, who's here and at the table with you, has also been just terrific in terms of providing a guiding hand and a very thoughtful approach to ensuring that we can maximize the contributions of the committee in very important and direct ways. And her expertise is much appreciated as well. So I wanted to call out the assets, some of the assets that in terms of human assets that are here to support the work that this committee does. As I mentioned, though, I also wanted to comment just a bit on your work going forward, both in terms of the operations, how you go about your work, as well as what's underway in the broader environment in which you're conducting your activity. I'd like to just make a nod in both of those directions. First of all, it goes almost goes without saying in a room like this that in the United States today, of course, our infant mortality rates remain a really harsh reminder that we still have unfinished business from the 20th century that we've carried over into this century in terms of rates of infant mortality. It is pretty clear that even for all of its strengths of our healthcare system, of which there are many, in this country, too frequently, there are gaps in our ability and our execution to protect the very smallest and sometimes the most vulnerable of our population. So we continue to have a lot of work to do around improving the health of the nation's infants and children. That focus, that aim, is of paramount importance to this administration. And both to Secretary Sebelius, for example, not just HRSA or CDC, but to Secretary Sebelius and to the President as well. And they have, at higher levels of the administration, committed resources accordingly, recognizing the importance of doing everything that we can to protect the health of our smallest and often most fragile. For example, just to underscore that point, the President has, of course, engaged very, very early on in his administration the expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program. That boosted insurance coverage for children from low-income families from what it was then, back in 2009, right around 7 million children with insurance to where we find ourselves now as a result of CHIP. 11 million kids that have access to health insurance coverage. And I think every one of us knows in this room what that can mean in terms of screenings, access to screenings for illness prevention, and access to health promoting healthcare services. So that was a marker that was laid down very, very early his administration. And since then, of course, the Affordable Care Act has started to roll out provisions that are guiding what we're doing, both within HRSA and more broadly across HHS, with a new focus on expanding access, improving quality, and really not talked about very much in newspapers, et cetera, but really focusing on preventing illness and mitigating chronic conditions, promoting health for all Americans, in no small part by breaking down barriers to screening services. So you see immediately the nexus between what that broader, what many of the provisions of that broader piece of the law look like and the very work that you do right here. A real crystallized focus on ensuring access to screening services, primary care, and preventive care as well, especially for the young. Some of the provisions that I want to just mention, because I think they have clear implications for individuals and families impacted by heritable disorders, are worth noting, again, because they provide the environment and the context for your specific work. So, for example, the Affordable Care Act now bans copayments for basic preventive health services and screenings, and it ends the practice of denying coverage for pre-existing conditions. That is an incredibly important provision, ending the practice of denying coverage for pre-existing conditions. That's about as important as we can get, I think, in some respects, in protecting children and families with heritable disorders and impacted by heritable disorders. The Affordable Care Act also has another important provision that allows dependents to remain on their parents' health insurance plans until age 26. Our recent data, just a couple of weeks old, shows us that we've got about a million more individuals, young adults under the age of 26, that now have insurance coverage as a result of that provisions. Why does that matter to you and why should you care about that? Well, it's pretty obvious, because many of those individuals under age 26 have and had heritable disorders that would have been, until now, previously uninsurable as they entered young adulthood. So it's an important provision for the population that we are here talking about. Also, of course, in the law and relevant to the population that is the focus of your work, we have, of course, now the establishment of high-risk insurance pools that provide a safety net for people with pre-existing conditions that were previously denied coverage. And another important provision relevant to this population, the elimination of lifetime caps on benefits. That relieves really a particularly cruel burden that families and individuals, infants and young children, have had to face in order, a barrier, if you will, to their obtaining necessary, often life-sustaining, regular costly therapies. The law also reauthorized until 2015 the Family-to-Family Information Centers program. Those are about 41 centers across the United States staffed by parents with children that have special health needs. And through those 41 Family-to-Family centers, you have seen the linkage of about 170,000 families with special health needs to federal programs, state programs, clinics, special insurance pools, rehabilitation services, and so on, to give kids with disabilities, including heritable disorders, a better a shot, and their families a fuller understanding of what resources might be made available to them. Also, a new, brand new provision within the Affordable Care Act that HRSA has been very involved with implementing is the deployment of the home visiting program that's administered by HRSA in conjunction with the Administration on Children and Families. Under that program, you might know, social workers, nurses, other healthcare providers visit expectant mothers and their families in high-risk communities. There, those providers engage counseling services that are really designed to improve health outcomes for mothers and infants, focusing on issues around school readiness, for example, for children, focusing on economic self-sufficiency and other dimensions important to ensuring that we've got the best possible platform that we can help build under those families in those high-risk communities. The research underpinnings of that program, of the home visiting program, are solid. They clearly indicate that interventions sooner decrease the need for more costly clinical care and social services later. So that's an evidence-based provision in the law that is being deployed across the country now and clearly will have implications, too, for families, that subset of families that have children with heritable disorders. And of course, the last point that I'd want to raise for you that again has the potential to impact the same population that is the business about which you're engaging here through your committee's work is to call out to the community health center's investment. It might not be readily evident for you about how that work also impacts this population, but just to give you a frame of reference, currently health centers provide prenatal care to about 500,000 expectant mothers every year. About 67% of those mothers, they are seen in their first trimester in health centers. And the health centers are linked to about 178,000 births in this country. So people don't always think about that in terms of the role of community health centers in terms of prenatal care and care for neonates, but they have a very significant footprint. Health centers also, just to extend this just a minute more, also immunize about 233,000 kids under the age of 2 each year. They administer lead tests to about 300,000. They manage over 540,000 cases of asthma, provide early detection screening that identifies on average thousands of children per year who have hearing, developmental, perinatal disorders, and other conditions. So the point is that as a community health center's system, that piece of the Affordable Care Act expands as it is now and will over the next few years, as it expands, so too will the population that's served by that safety net infrastructure. And over time, prenatal care, as a result of that expansion, will be available to tens of thousands of additional mothers, and immunizations and screenings will be offered to tens of thousands more infants. And those patients, as an aside, are more and more cared for in the context of health homes or medical homes. Health centers across the country are increasingly picking up on, where they didn't have them already, dimensions that are used to coordinate care and in the process boost quality. In addition to the Affordable Care Act, we've got a lot of other things underway, too many to call out now, but I want to just mention two of them. One of them that I hope that you've heard of is HRSA's partnership with the National Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies Coalition. And it's a partnership that we engage with CDC and that the White House was very much part of when this was first initiated. And this is the Text for Baby effort that's underway. It is an opportunity that allows us to provide expectant mothers and mothers that have given birth with free text messages, reminding them of how they can take care of their own health and the health of their infants, and really help to give them the opportunity to give their babies really the very best start in life. And those text messages are timed to the birth date. So they're tailored to where that woman is in her pregnancy and or post delivery. Text for Baby sends messages 3 times a week to young and expectant mothers who otherwise might be hard to reach, but who typically often have cell phones readily available to them. And this has been a public-private partnership that the White House is very much part of, that's continued forward, and that we're pleased to be able to engage in as well. It includes, of course, reminders to mothers about the importance of screenings for their newborns. So it's a great use of technology and resources, and as I said, an important public-private partnership. As a matter of fact, we're now exploring ways to expand that out to encompass older children, ages 1 to 5, and using that technology in other ways as well. So there are certainly our opportunities to expand what we're doing and how we exert our influence more broadly on ensuring the importance of screening and then access to follow-up services through the array of provisions that I've mentioned thus far. The last point that I just make with all of this is just to say that hopefully this provides you with a sense of what we're engaged in at HRSA and then at HHS and the administration more broadly, that we have the opportunity, I think, now perhaps more than ever, to really couple our efforts with yours to strengthen the health care and the health of infants and children in this country, and to ensure that when we do have challenging healthcare problems that are impacting families across the nation, we've got far better, more robust tools to bring to the table to impact favorably those challenges that individuals wrestle with across the nation. You, as a federal advisory committee, of course, have a different role from what I've just described, but I very much wanted you to know that your commitment is shared by us to ensure that we do give infants in our country the very best start in life and that we provide the services needed wrapped around children with very special health needs. Your advice to us and your expertise to inform the work that we have underway already is critically important. It's a great opportunity, I think, for all of us now to engage what are extremely important challenges. And I welcome you again, and thank you again for your service. And if there's anything that I can need to either hear from you, need to know, or you might have a question about, I'd be happy to try and take that for just a minute now. And then I'm going to not stay, but just a minute, because I need to chair a meeting back out at that really lovely Park Lawn building that Dr. Liu now gets to call his new home. I'm sure it rivals his former setting out in California. Not. So is there anything in particular to the chair or to the committee members that I either need to hear or could respond to you in terms of your questions or concerns?
Dr. Wakefield, thank you very much for for coming and for that presentation. I think it's very clear the role that this committee plays for HRSA and how HRSA looks at the committee and its contributions to your overall effort. So we appreciate that.
Of course. And I might just add that, you know, as you know, and maybe you've already discussed, this committee's reauthorization is up in 2013. And I think this will be a good time for the committee to start to think about examining how you function, how you do your work in the context of what I've just shared. As you know, and I probably should have said this, we've got lots of new tools, but we're also operating in an environment where there is scrutiny, an appropriate scrutiny, I'd say, on how we deploy our resources. So even as you conduct the important work that you're doing, I would ask you to pay very close attention as we think about how we position the operations of this committee to consider how you engage your effectiveness in the context of what we're seeing, another backdrop, and that is budget deficits and so on. Your ability to streamline operations of this committee will be important. Ways that you can identify to improve the efficiencies of the committee to meet your statutory expectations also extremely important, and we welcome your ideas. And I know that's part of your agenda today. That's extremely important, not just in terms of meeting the expectations of the administration and Congress. It's a look that we're asking all of our advisory committees to engage in, just as frankly we are doing it in very real time within our Maternal Child Health Bureau and across every single bureau division that we operate at HRSA. As a matter of fact, it will be part of the conversation that I'll have with our senior leaders at HRSA. Again, it's a weekly conversation almost now when I'm back out in our office in about 45 minutes. Dr. Liu will miss that conversation, but he got a good taste of it yesterday in our one-on-one. So all by way of saying, you are not immune from those expectations to think about how we can really efficiently deploy our resources. No advisory committee is, no part of HHS is. So please help us with that, too.
Thank you. I'll open to the committee if there are any questions for Dr. Wakefield. Well, if there are none from the committee, let's go to liaisons. Freddie?
Hi, Dr. Wakefield.
Dr. Chen, you're everywhere.
Good morning. Nice to see you. I just wanted to point out a couple other really nice parallels and features of this committee's work over the last few years. One is really the focus on evidence-based medicine as applied to the way we are analyzing the issues that come before the group now, and that's supported as well in the ACA. The second is, as we move into more attention to service delivery models, the interprofessional work that happens around the care of these children and for these conditions is really worth noting, and I think a very strong example of some of the new models of care that are also supported in the ACA. At the same time, the challenges, as you mentioned, are very real. The budgetary ones facing public health departments around the country are ones that we run into as we think about how we make our recommendations, as well as the expensive care for many of these conditions.
Yeah, you make such great points, Freddie. The especially the comments about fielding coordinated a care that capitalizes on the strengths of an array of providers, how important that is, particularly for populations that like these that are the focus of this particular committee. HRSA has been, the ACA gives us some new tools in that area. HRSA has been focused very explicitly on working with national organizations to try and drive that agenda forward. And it's really quite critical. We can think, I think, about redesigning healthcare delivery and trying to support, for example, accountable care organizations. We can't really think about that and get very far, I think, without also thinking about the individuals that are being deployed within those now increasing... Oh, it's a sad thing when you don't turn off your own cell phone. gosh, sorry. Well, it is a great song, and you're dating yourself by recognizing it. So yes, for those of you who are very young in the room, you probably wouldn't recognize it. But anyway, I don't even remember what I was saying now. Very important, and in fact, I know what I was going to say. I had a little bit of a nod to that. I was going to go on a little bit longer, but because the time didn't. I had a little bit of nod to that in terms of this committee's contribution when I recognized earlier the statements from an earlier, much earlier report that talked about the different providers. It's not just the screening, but then it's the delivery of services, post findings, and the importance of engaging primary care providers there. And so I think you've already commented on this, and you did it earlier than some have recognized the importance of engaging that broader team approach. But clearly, it's a high priority for us. It is because HRSA has a lot of programs that we deploy that have that deal directly in the area of strengthening the healthcare workforce, especially around primary care. And we'll be continuing to push that agenda forward for all the reasons that I think would be quite evident to most of you. And if there's one or two more comments, I'll take it. But otherwise, I'm going to have to leave.
Chris.
Yeah, Chris Cuss from the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. One of the things you emphasized was that this group helped in getting states to, it didn't matter where kids were, that they were getting tested. I think in the discussion about the Affordable Care Act, it's important that the treatment shouldn't depend on where they live. And as we discussed, essential benefit package and things, that's a critical point for the work of this committee.
Sure. The essential benefits package absolutely is relevant. And I think one more good example of a set of tools that we have broadly now because of the law that we can deploy going forward. So it's an extremely important point. There are many other provisions, too, that are important, and just too many of them to mention here this morning. But all of which directly or indirectly affect, impact, relate to either your work or at the very least, the populations that your work is about. So with that, thank you. I'm going to extricate myself and my cell phone. And thanks again to each of you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Beverly Dart. From the HHS Office of General Counsel. She is senior attorney with the Council Public Health Division and has been with HHS OGC for 7 years, served 21 years with the Navy and the Department of Defense, including positions as a health law, international law, and claims attorney. In her current position, she advises various HRSA programs, including MCHB. She's going to give us an overview of the Secretary's Advisory Committee legislation.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here today. I'm glad to have the chance to speak with you. I appreciate the invitation to talk about the legal framework generally for the work of the Advisory Committee. I think it provides a good structural foundation for purposes of talking about your work. I want to talk about basically two points. I should give you a little bit of background about, as an OGC attorney, what my role is, as it has some bearing on the committee, and also talk about the legal framework generally for the committee's work, and specifically talking about the Federal Advisory Committee Act, which provides one leg of the framework, the authorizing legislation for the committee itself, which is another leg of the framework, and also the impact of Section 2713 of the Affordable Care Act, which was the Public Health Service Act, which was added by the Affordable Care Act. Let's see. I think it's helpful to know just a little bit about the role of the Office of General Counsel, because you may have questions about some of the application and implementation of some of the information you hear. I should explain that the Office of the General Counsel provides legal advice and assistance to the department. We are government attorneys, so we advise at the broadest level the department, and then basically from the macrocosm down to the microcosm. So we provide legal advice and assistance specifically to HRSA, Maternal Child Health Bureau, and specifically that's one of my designated clients across the board. As well as other HHS organizations and officials, and other OGC attorneys might be designated to primarily focus on other operating divisions, other activities. And then finally, we provide advice to the program officials who are specifically charged with implementation of certain programs. So specifically, as it relates to the committee, to the DFO for purposes of committee matters. So given that that's the role of OGC, what we don't do is that we don't give specific legal advice to the committee itself. Essentially, we're in dialogue, if you will, or maybe trialogue, if there's such a thing. But because the law sets a legal framework, it has also aspects of programmatic implementation. So our primary dialogue is with MCHB and the DFO, as far as the activities of the committee, and obviously informed by what's occurring within the committee. So I offered that by way of context as well. As far as the basic legal framework, the Federal Advisory Committee Act actually is our starting place. This is a federal law that was enacted in 1972, and it's further implemented by the Code of Federal Regulations, has much more substantive content to it. It's actually a GSA regulation. So the Federal Advisory Committee Act is broader than HHS. It basically extends throughout the federal government. And its application is basically when either Congress or an agency establishes or it manages, has a group that essentially the role of it is first that is essentially made of people who are not originally federal government employees for the purpose of obtaining advice, recommendations, information, recommendations on agency issues, policies, practices. And that's the general idea of what a Federal Advisory Committee Act was set up to address. It was established in 1972, and in large part it was a response to the fact that advisory committees had sprung up over time, and there was a sense that there was a need for greater information standardization of what their actual practices were. They are also intended to advance the idea that the advice being provided by committees is objective, it's accessible to the public, and it emphasizes, therefore, open meetings, the charter itself for the committee, involvement of the public, and reporting, all as evidenced by this kind of meeting today. You'll see that advisory committees under the Federal Advisory Committee Act do not necessarily have to be called advisory committees. The name is less important than the function that they perform. And they can be established by a variety of mechanisms. They can be established by statute, as in the case of this committee. They can be established or used by the president or by one of the agencies. And again, the primary objective is to obtain advice or recommendations for whatever the designated federal organization is for the purpose of doing the work that's established for them. So in essence, the function of advisory committees is to provide advice to, in this particular case, to the secretary. And it's an advisory type function. It doesn't self-execute, it's advisory in nature. The department also has certain legal statutory responsibilities relating to the administration of the work of advisory committees. It's supposed to establish uniform guidelines, management controls, following the GSA directives found in regulation. and it also maintains information on the work of the committee in a variety of different areas. The agency is required to designate an advisory committee management officer who fulfills certain basically administrative functions, but what you'll see is that they, again, provide a framework for the work of the committee. The first one probably most clearly so, that there is an element of structuring the procedures and accomplishments of what the work of the committee is to be. And within HHS and with respect to this particular committee, of course, MCHB performs most of the responsibilities relative to this committee on behalf of the secretary and HHS. So that now I'd like to move on to the actual authorizing legislation for the committee itself. And this is found in section 1111, I guess we tend to refer to it as, of the Public Health Service Act, which is found codified in the United States Code at 42 USC section 300B10. And I'm doing a short summary of the essence of the law and what the authority of the committee is, but essentially it is advice, information, and recommendations to the secretary in various specified areas relating to newborn and childhood screening. You would see in the legislation itself that there's a lot of specificity, a lot more detail about what exactly is within that, but the law itself sets the basic parameters for the work of the committee. Further elaboration or application of those would be by the program officials who exercise that general structural role. So the authorizing legislation basically sets the core legal standards for what is within its purview and what's not, and the essence of it is advice, information, and recommendation to the secretary in certain identified areas, and that which is not within is generally without, subject to some degree of programmatic interpretation and application. The third legal framework piece that we wanted to mention today was to talk about the preventive care and screenings, as Dr. Wakefield mentioned. The Affordable Care Act added Section 2713 of the Public Health Service Act, and that's had a great deal of impact on one aspect of the committee's work. The recommended uniform screening panel, as probably many of, if not most of you know, now is part of the preventive care and screenings for infants, children, and adolescents that are provided for in comprehensive guidelines supported by HRSA, as these are called for by the law. So basically what this means in practical fact is that those recommendations for additions to the RUSP that are adopted by the secretary and therefore are included as part of the RUSP now have impact in terms of being a requirement for them to be covered by non-grandfathered group health plans and health insurance issuers without cost share. So basically, once they're added to the RUSP by decision of the secretary, there is a further legal impact, a further public health impact as a result of that adoption. And this is only as the result of the enactment of the ACA. So it must be therefore clear that what is required is not, even though it is the RUSP and the conditions on the RUSP, it is actually the adoption of the recommendations that triggers that effect. So generally speaking, for purposes again of a framework, the committee has a statutory purpose. Its purpose is tied to information, advice, and assistance to the secretary, and it's within that context that the committee functions. At this point, I'd sort of shift just a little bit. I'd like to mention, basically on behalf of the program, a couple of programmatic takeaways from this. So this is a specific application of specific facts and how exactly to proceed. It's programmatic. We lawyers give advice and counsel to our program clients, but ultimately the decisions are made by the program. So takeaways from this is that the kinds of things that are well within the purview of the legislation and basically the program would like you to know these are things that are on your go ahead, kind of this is the area that you are have a clear pathway forward, is the recommendation of additions of conditions to the RUSP, the recommendation of certain direction or advice to other HHS agencies, and specifically in the area of directing the newborns Newborn Screening Saving Lives Act grant program. I knew I could get it out. The areas which are trickier, have more caution in, certainly more need for dialogue with the program on, have to do with when you are not providing that kind of advice, assistance, and recommendations to the secretary. So when you think in terms of making recommendations direct to states, that's an area to be kept for caution, as well as direct interaction and recommendations to other entities other than the Department of Health and Human Services. That's all I have for today, and I'll be glad to take your questions, recognizing that specifics and what exactly, how it would be applied in specific circumstances is really more of a program issue, so that I would commend to your further discussion at other times. Okay?
Okay. Would you like to speak to the issues related to reauthorization, or is that...
Not really. I think Dr. Wakefield has really said it all.
She doesn't work.
Doesn't work that part. Okay.
No,
all right.
GC doesn't work with it that much.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Additional questions?
There's none. Yeah.
Okay.
Carol? Hi. I wonder if you could put back up the slide with the authorization for the committee.
I will try to do that.
Great, thank you. Up on the screen, it has three bullets, and as you went forward, you mentioned only newborn and childhood screening, and then in your examples, you mentioned only screening. Is this committee's authorization only for screening? My recollection of the original language is that it was for anything to do with prevention of reduction of death and disability from hereditary disease and not focused solely on screening.
I apologize. I may have shorthanded just a tad bit for purposes of efficiency in the providing of this presentation. Is there anything else, Sarah, that you would want to say to that?
No, apart from the fact that really, Beverly's been responding more to the previous actions and just making sure, providing context for that. But as she said, she shortened it. This is definitely a heritable disorders committee, and for the past several years, it's been mostly focused on newborn screening because that's where you can see a lot of the immediate impact, but definitely the scope is much broader than that. I'd also like to point out that I put together the slides with the pictures. I had to talk her into that.
All right. Okay. Freddie?
It may be a question really for the public health labs, but the addition of the uniform panel to the requirements for coverage, I wasn't clear that private insurers, commercial insurers, pay for the newborn screening procedures currently. Is this a major change for labs and the coverage of the cost of the screening labs?
Okay. So currently most newborn screening is rolled into the newborn screening fee, as you know, but sometimes there are screens that are done outside of the birth. And those often are billed to the insurance companies, which is why in some states the insurance plans are so involved in what is added to the panel because of the cost to that. But the main point being that even if it's on the RUSP, even if it's not on your state newborn screening panel, the insurance companies have to cover it. So I think that was the main point.
So I'm trying to understand that. A state that doesn't or is in the process of adding a condition, it would still be covered. What does that mean?
So Iowa currently doesn't have SCID on their panel.
Okay.
But if a family wanted their baby to be screened for SCID, their insurance company would have to cover that because it's on RUSP.
So it's the parent request in a state that's not covered. Is that fair?
Well, for the most part, yeah. But it could be a certain hospital has added supplemental.
Right. I got you.
And so there's some states where it's not all uniform. But the impact being that it's essentially a rulemaking that insurance has to cover it once it's added to the RUSP, whether or not the state has adopted it.
Gotcha. So. Okay.
So thank you for this. This is a good overview. I'm a little confused about your comment about concerns about us making recommendations to states, because essentially we're recommending things to the secretary, who then makes recommendations to the states.
Exactly.
So could you say anything more about that?
I think that you've made the point exactly, is that that's your pathway, if you will, that your pathway is the recommendations to the secretary, and those recommendations might take a variety of forms.
But the idea being that the secretary and her ability to influence the states has a limited scope, mm-hmm. especially if there's going to be a requirement of additional funds. Mm-hmm. So it's just thinking about how we frame our recommendations and how we frame what we send forward to the secretary, so we don't put her in a position where we're asking her to make recommendations to the states that may or may not be in her purview.
Well, again, thank you for this nice summary. Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a better sheet for roll call now, so I can look around the table and see who's here. But for on the telephone, is Charlie Homer on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And how about Fred Laurie?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Is there anybody else on the phone?
Hi, this is Elizabeth Bradshaw from Children's National.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to do my housekeeping notes. So, everybody to get oriented, when you exit the general session, the restrooms are all the way down the hall to the left at the end of the hallway on this floor. The food out there is not for us. Sorry. On the public comments, we had a lot of people sign up for public comments ahead of time, and if you signed up out there as well, if you still want to speak, please be sure and put your topic area next to it so that we can know in order to maybe make sure that other people have a chance. If there's a huge group that wants to speak on one topic, it would be nice if other people on other topics had a chance to speak as well. So when you sign up outside, if you could let us know. The Altarum staff will be at the registration desk to direct and assist all of you and answer any questions that you may have. There is not wireless access for everybody in the room, but the hotel offers complimentary wireless in the hotel lobby. Subcommittees are held from 3 to 5, and they're all down on this floor. The lab standards and procedures are in salon 1 and 2, down the hall on the right. The follow-up and treatment is going to stay here, and education and training is next door in gallery 3 ballroom. If any of the presenters change your presentations after submitting them, please save the revised copy of your presentation on the laptop. And just so you know, on the agenda, the tab for the presentation is indicated in parentheses. So if you want to tab back and forth to look at any of the background materials, et cetera, you can. Everybody should, all the committee members, organizational reps, and presenters should have received a thumb drive that contains the supplement to your briefing book. If you have not, please let us know or stop by the registration desk. And if you're going to dinner, please meet in the lobby at 6:15 and also indicate on the sign-up list. And now I'm going to hand it over to Joe.
Well, let's complete the role by allowing each committee member to introduce themselves. If you just tell us who you are and what area or organization you're involved with. And at the same time, if you would indicate whether you have any conflicts of interest, this would be important to just identify individuals who may need to withhold from a vote as we go forward. So the other thing that's important is that for the people who are recording, this meeting. For them to be able to turn on your microphone, would you please just kind of raise your hand before you speak so that they can identify who's going to speak? I think at this point, we'll help them by, if we can start with Colleen to introduce herself, go around the table for the committee members, that will help that, and then we'll go to the liaison.
Okay, thanks. Well, good morning, everyone. I'm Colleen Boyle. I'm the director for the National Center on Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at CDC.
Hi, I'm Kathy Wickland. I'm a genetic counselor, and I direct the graduate program in genetic counseling at Northwestern University.
Denise Doherty, I'm the Senior Advisor for Child Health and Quality Improvement at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality.
Good morning. I'm Alexis Thompson. I'm the Head of Pediatric Hematology at Children's Memorial Hospital at Northwestern University in Chicago.
Hello, I'm Kelly Kelm. I'm from the Division of Chemistry and Toxicology Devices in the Office of In Vitro Diagnostic Devices and the Center of Devices at FDA.
I'm Dieter Matern. I'm from the Mayo Clinic. I'm a co-director of the Biochemical Genetics Lab. Our laboratory provides screening for the state of Minnesota, at least part of the screening, by tandem SPEC. I'm also involved in an NICHD contract that allows us to do a comparative effectiveness study of screening in lysosomal storage disorders and a few others.
Steve McDonough, I'm a general pediatrician from Bismarck, North Dakota. I've been there for 32 years. Also spent 15 years of my career as, in the North Dakota Department of Health and oversaw the metabolic screening then.
Hi, I'm Andrea Williams, Executive Director of Children's Sickle Cell Foundation in Pittsburgh.
Jeff Botkin, pediatrician, do bioethics at the University of Utah.
Don Bailey, I'm a research fellow at RTI International, a nonprofit research organization in North Carolina.
Joe Bocchini, I'm chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center in Shreveport.
I'm Sarah Copeland. I'm the acting chief of the Genetic Services Branch at the Health Resources Services Administration, Maternal and Child Health Bureau, and the Division of Services for Children with Special Health Needs. And I'm also the designated federal officer for this committee.
Good morning. I'm Michael Liu. I'm director of Maternal and Child Health Bureau, representing the Health Services and Resource, Health Resources and Service Administration.
I'm Beverly Dart. I'm an attorney with the Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of the General Counsel.
Yeah, and then the three people who are on the telephone? Two people on the telephone, sorry. Fred, you want to start?
Sure. I'm Fred Lurie, and I'm not supposed to use this title, but I think I'm among friends. Acting Director of Genetic Disease Screening Program in Richmond, California, and that includes newborn screening and prenatal screening.
Okay, and then Charlie?
Yes, this is Charlie Homer. I'm the CEO of the National Initiative for Children's Healthcare Quality, which is a nonprofit working on quality improvement for children. I'm on the faculty at Boston Children's and Harvard Medical School, Harvard School of Public Health. And NICHGU also serves as the National Coordinating Center for two of Maternal Child Health Bureau's sickle cell disease programs.
Thank you. Okay, liaisons. Fred?
Good morning. Freddie Chen. I'm the faculty at the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm here as the organizational liaison for the American Academy of Family Physicians.
Hello, my name is Beth Torini. I'm a faculty at the University of Michigan, where I'm a pediatrician health services researcher, and I'm here as a liaison for the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Good morning, I'm Alan Hogue from the University of Pittsburgh, representing the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
And I'm Jane Getchell, Senior Director for Public Health Programs at the Association of Public Health Laboratories, and I'm here representing APHL.
Thank you. Carol?
Good morning. I'm Carol Green. I'm faculty at University of Maryland. I'm a clinical geneticist, head of the clinical genetics clinic there, and I am representing the Society for Inherited Metabolic Disorders. I'm the current president.
I'm Jolie Simpson. I've just started as a Senior Vice President for Research and Global Programs at the March of Dimes. I am an obstetrician gynecologist and a geneticist certified in both, and previous president of the American College of Medical Genetics, where I was honored to work with Dr. Watson, who just walked in the room. So.
Natasha Benham, project director for the Newborn Screening Clearinghouse and representing Genetic Alliance.
Teresa Hart, I am the perinatal nurse consultant for TRICARE Management Activity representing Department of Defense.
Good morning, I'm Chris Cuss. I'm a pediatrician. I'm the associate medical director, Division of Family Health, New York State Department of Health, and I'm representing the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials.
And Mike, since you made the... I thought you just made it in time.
Yeah, Mike Watson from the American College of Medical Genetics.
Thank you. All right. You note that we have a different configuration around the table today. The goal here is to follow what most federal advisory committees do by having the voting members in the center, followed by the liaisons surrounding, and we. There may be additional adjustments, but this is the reason for the change here. The first item on the agenda for the committee is approval of minutes from the September 2011 meeting. These were sent to you prior to the meeting. Are there any additions or corrections to be made? Steve?
President Miner, on page 33, third paragraph, discuss the disease, third line. Since then, a log of progress have been made in diagnosing. It should be a lot of progress. Just a typo.
Okay, thank you. Additional?
On Dieter? Page 36, I don't think that Dr. Howell said anything about a tyrosine immunotype 1. I think he meant tyrosinemia type 1.
Thank you.
And then on page 38, I think in the middle, members feel that the subcommittee would benefit from increased participation by American Congress on obstetricians. I think it's the College of Obstetricians.
You guys really read them. Thank you.
There is a difference between the College and the Congress, but right. Dr. Hogue could probably elucidate us more than I can.
I think the purposes of this meeting is the College.
But I don't know what was meant in that.
I believe it was the College, yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then there's another one on page 9, and I don't know if that was actually stated, but it would be wrong. At the bottom, Ms. Monaco used talked about something, and she said at the time of the advisory committee's inception, the majority of states were not screening newborns, and I don't think that's right.
Right.
Okay.
So in order to properly record and give the people that are recording this some time to figure out who's doing what, we're going to have people go one by one. But first we need to ask for any abstentions on the vote. Oh, I guess we need a movement first, so never mind.
Right. So if there are no other additions or corrections, can we have move to accept the minutes with the corrections as indicated? Steve McDonough, second. Dieter, second. Okay, so then now we have to.
Are there any abstentions for voting on the minutes? Yes, Kathy.
If I'm a new committee member,
You get to vote. You don't have to abstain.
Even though I was not sitting in.
That's right. Yeah. So are there any abstentions on the vote? Okay, I'm going to go through the roll. Dr. Bailey? Aye or nay? Okay. Dr. Bocchini?
Approved.
Dr. Botkin?
Approved.
Dr. Homer?
Approved.
Dr. Laurie?
Yes.
Dr. McDonough?
Aye.
Dr. Matern?
Approved.
Dr. Thompson?
Approved.
Ms. Wickland?
Approved.
Ms. Williams? And for AHRQ, Denise Doherty?
Approved.
For CDC, Colleen Boyle? For FDA, Kelly Kelm?
Approved.
For HRSA, Dr. Liu?
Approved.
For NIH, they are absent. So the overwhelming is approved. Thank you, guys.
All right. So we are considerably ahead of schedule. I'll guarantee this will probably be the last time under my tenure that that will happen. That's good. So what we'll do is I think we can initiate a break now, given the fact that we're ahead of schedule. Shall we come back at 10:45? And then this way we can initiate the second part of the program a little bit ahead of schedule. With that, let's go on break and return at 10:45 to go return to the meeting. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. There is no committee correspondence, so that's right.